Classic example is the giraffe. According to Lamarck, the giraffe would have started out with a short neck that made it difficult.
Помните, я помню про, ну, слово-то не помню, но я помню, что в учебниках биологии были про ламаркизм. Эволюция не имеет мозгов, бла-бла-бла. Кто-то говорит, что она имеет.
Eves it liked to eat. So, while feeding, the giraffe would stretch its neck, craning to get food, and in the process, its neck would get slightly longer. Then, when the giraffe had a baby, the baby would inherit the neck its mother or father had stretched during life. To make the absurdity of Lamarckism more obvious, imagine believing that your baby's hairstyle was determined by the hairstyle you had when conceiving it. Yeah, it's not great, but Darwin's pangenesis theory supported Lamarckism. If your eye cells were constantly producing gemmules with their properties, and your eyes became damaged from looking into the sun, from eye strain, from gouging them out after discovering you married your mother, the gemmules produced from then on out ought to contain that damage, even though, obviously, this wasn't so. Worse still for Darwin was the blending part of pangenesis. When one parent had brown eyes and the other had blue, their offspring usually had brown eyes too, sometimes blue. But hardly ever did their children have blended blue-brown eyes.
Я говорю о мутации. А, нет, все, все, молчи. Мутация, как... Я говорю о мутациях, как... Ну, как вообще... А если не мутация, что это такое? Хорошо, как появились? И мутация — это как бы единица изменения вида, рандомное изменение вида, которое либо закрепляется, если это полезно и помогает индивидууму выжить, либо нет, либо он вымирает, не закрепляется, так как не помогает индивидууму выжить. Это вроде как бы такое базовое, самое простое понимание теории эволюции, нет? Жало появилось не на ровном месте, но вот в результате такой длинной какой-то цепочки мутации, которые как-то примерно привели к жалу. Я не пытаюсь сейчас что-то переменить, я пытаюсь хотя бы, чтобы мы... пытаясь привести к общему пониманию постановки вопроса. Который ладно, все, а то мы никогда не дослушаем.
Which is what pangenesis seemed to anticipate. Worse still, sometimes a set of parents that each had brown eyes, nevertheless...
Альтруистические черты... Черты могут помочь виду выжить, но тогда они же не закрепятся в популяции, потому что пчела с альтруистической мутацией умрет. Она не а потом... Я не... Хорошо. Так, все. Просто слушай. Хорошо, мне надо не участвовать, знаешь, вот вы сами встретитесь, а вот... Не следить, а ведите научную дискуссию.
Class gave birth to a blue, but hard.
Так, мы слушаем, не теряем котес, мы слушаем про ламаркизм. Ламаркизм, поняли, в чем суть ламаркизма? В том, что черты, передающиеся детям, родителями могут быть получены в течение жизни, то бишь жираф всю жизнь тянулся повыше к к яблочку повыше, вот-вот за жизнь он вытянул пчелу, вытянул, блядь, пчелу, вытянул шею, растянул шею, поэтому вот, вот-вот, дети с длинной шеей. Жало это бывший... Не готов с этим спорить, но нет, как бы, жало, то бишь, альтруистические черты, это на самом деле черты, которые рандом, ну а почему яйцеклад превратился в жало? Почему яйцеклад превратился в жало? Я что-то не понял. Почему он полезен индивидууму? Он вреден. Потому что индивидуум умирает.
Never did their children have...
Все, я затыкаюсь.
Did blue and brown eye.
Потому что, на самом деле, мне больше тут интересно, хотя это интересно, вот первая часть про научную историю вопроса, это и сложно, и интересно. А дальше будет... ну, это как-то... Ну, вот я тупой, для меня это хоть и интересно, но это сложно. А то, что во второй части будет, это... Как бы не так сложно, потому что это более про жизнь кое-каких конкретных людей, занимающихся этим вопросом. И интересно, ну, потому что это про драматическую жизнь людей. Некоторых конкретных людей. Трагично.
And the other had blue.
Скоро уже дойдем до этой части.
Their offspring usually had brown eyes too. Sometimes blue. But hardly ever did their children have blended blue-brown eyes, which is what pangenesis seemed to anticipate. Worse still, sometimes a set of parents that each had brown eyes nevertheless gave birth to a blue-eyed baby, which seemed completely outside of pangenesis's range of possibilities. But blended inheritance, as the idea is typically called, wasn't just incompatible with observable reality, it also flew directly in the face of Darwin's own theory of natural selection, which he had hoped it would bolster. A year before Darwin published his pangenesis theory, a Scottish polymath named Henry Fleeming Jenkin, who invented the cable car, had done the math. New mutations could not thrive through blending. If one parent had some new favorable trait, it would necessarily be immediately diluted by half when they mated with their other non-mutant parent. Pangenesis didn't just not explain natural selection, it made natural selection impossible. Meanwhile, a Moravian monk by the name of Gregor Mendel had started growing peas. Between 1856 and 1863, he'd performed experiments with almost 30,000 plants, and from those experiments had come to a proper understanding of heredity. The traits of parents were passed on discreetly to their offspring, with some being dominant and others recessive. Traits didn't blend, but a recessive one could lie dormant, waiting to link up with another recessive trait down another generation or two, and then expressing itself again. Brown-eyed father, brown-eyed mother, blue-eyed baby. In 1865, Mendel had presented his results to a small audience at the Natural History Society of Brno, but nobody seemed to understand what he meant. Scientists either didn't listen at all, or if they did, they took his experiments as being about hybridization, how to grow different pea strains, and nothing more. This put evolution on the ropes, and the question of individual versus group selection relatively moot. Until 1900, when two researchers, Hugo de Vries and Karl Korens, each independently replicated and rediscovered Gregor Mendel's experiments. Mendelian inheritance, or what we might as well just call genetics, presented an explanation for how natural selection worked in the real world. It took a couple of decades to figure that out precisely, but by midway through World War I, two other biologists had made the case. R.A. Fisher produced a mathematical model showing how genetics allowed for variation and natural selection in populations. And J.B.S. Haldane went one better, showing how the peppered moth, a typically mottled black and white insect, had actually evolved to become all black around the city, coal-powered city of Manchester. Natural selection was demonstrably real and worked through the mutation and inheritance of discrete traits through genes. This discovery is typically called the modern synthesis, and it hearkened a brand new day for biologists. They seemingly had all the tools they needed now to...
Да, и ступай, ступай. Вот Лендер ушел, но вроде бы вот Тивачер, Тивачер заинтересовался, еще кто-то слушает, да. Ну, если ты хочешь обсуждения, ладно, ладно, ладно. Хотя за такие сообщения хочется тебя просто нахуй послать. Да, 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 да. Мы просто слушаем подкаст, но. Но хотя нет, тут другой тоже. Другой тоже не слушает, судя по его сообщениям. А почему у тебя мошонка свисает? Ведь индивидуум невозможно, просто неудачно упав. Это тоже альтруизм? То есть это обобщение поведенческого паттерна среди особей с развитой высшей нервной деятельностью. Очень узкое. Ладно, он тоже не слушает. Значит, возникновение жала или любых черт среди видов, которые можно считать альтруистическими, это просто хаос. Это просто рандом, да? Альтруизм очень обобщенный среди особей с развитой высшей нервной... Да, да, он тоже просто не слушает. Да, да. Окей. Значит, единственный, кто слушает, это Тивачер. Тивачер, будем дослушивать до конца. Тивачер, будем дослушивать до конца. А? Ну зачем вы так в какой-то веке могли послушать без постоянных пауз? А толку, судя по твоим сообщениям, ты ничего не понимаешь. Или ты понимаешь, что споришь с повествователем, с Дарвином и всеми теми учеными мужами, которые ставили вопрос альтруизма среди вообще всех живых организмов. Ты споришь с ними, говоря, что альтруизм на самом деле это очень низкое понятие, и только у людей они натягиваются на глобус, да? Сестра рассказали, почему... Нет. Ну не промкинг же мы будем. Давай только так второй тут я говорил не втором, короче.
For biologists, they seemingly had all the tools they needed now to understand evolution, and soon those tools would be put to use to end temporarily the Sharks versus Jets turf battle between the groupies and the Indies. Two men, W.D. Hamilton and George Price, were about to provide the first solid steps to understanding altruism. And it would change their lives, and ours, forever.
Пчела жало умирает. Хорошо, как работает базовая эволюция? Забудем о генах. Только забудем о генах. Нет, гены мы еще не открыли. Как базовая... Расскажи мне, как базовая... Естественный отбор работает. Естественный отбор и как бы эволюция при... Эволюция, движимая естественным отбором. Гены мы еще не открыли. Блять, что он мне пытается сказать? Бля, вот два черта ебаные, они постоянно... Кажется, что им вот что-то доказывают, и надо либо как бы с этим согласиться, либо спорить. Да, да, он приводит исторические справки, он рассказывает, он интересно, очень интересно рассказывает историю вопроса. Вы если что-то слушаете, вам нужно, наверное, чтобы вам как вам рассказывали, как срочно изменить, не знаю, общество, вот как ужалить кого-то, вот решение вопроса глобально либо локально, как бы просто исторические справки. Ладно, я тут уже сам набрасываю лишнего. Вот, подвели как раз к интересному. Тимач, ты надолго тут еще? Давай хотя бы, не знаю, 15 минут, ну, почти еще. Ну, интересного в плане. Now a word. Word from our sponsor, да?
From our sponsor, that's how we get back to work. Indeed is the organization for hire on delivery at the time. Hire, you need him to Hamilton and George.
Я спорю с тобой по поводу Ладно, давай, то есть, еще тут, хорошо. Пазл решить не хотите? Я что-то совсем тут, да.
The lives and professional stories of our main characters, William Donald Hamilton and George R. Price, are distressingly complicated.
Извините, он все-таки ответил. Базово это самоподобная система, существующая на протяжении миллионов самопад. Мне блять, иди нахуй. То есть ты ушел, скорее, от вопроса о том, как она работает, и почему. Почему ты подумал? Ты меня не убедил, что? Ты сначала ответь на вопрос. Ответь на вопрос, как базово работает эволюция. Базово. Самоподобная система, существующая на протяжении миллиардов лет.
The lives and professional stories of our main characters, William Donald Hamilton and George R. Price, are distressingly complicated.
Хотя все, не отвечай. Мы слушаем интересную часть, не прерывая.
William Donald Hamilton and George R. Price are distressingly complicated. Hamilton, sometimes known as W.D., other times as Bill, but rarely, if ever, as William, is widely regarded as one of the most important evolutionary biologists of the 20th century, and perhaps the most important Darwinian since Darwin, although some of his peers might take umbrage with both of those claims.
А так, Тимачер, ответь, ты здесь или не здесь? Ладно, давай, я не понял, ты ушел, либо типа, ладно, давай продолжать.
George Price, on the other hand, was until quite recently much more obscure, pulled to wide recognition only 12 years ago in an award-winning biography by Orrin Harman. Depending on your values, and to some extent your politics, it can be very easy to see one or the other of them, Hamilton or Price, as virtuous or villainous. And I'm going to try my best to avoid that, and I'm going to urge you to try along with me. The other caution we need to take in approaching Hamilton and Price is in our prejudice for their ideas. As you might have gathered from the Springbok example, the question of altruism is still very much a live ball, not just in biological or sociological circles, but in everyone. Even if you've never considered the question consciously, you most definitely have some sort of feeling about it. Maybe you really want to believe that there's good in the world, that people and perhaps animals and perhaps plants and perhaps fungi are capable of selflessness. Or maybe you're more cynical, and you expect that there's a hidden self-interest in even the most radical acts of kindness. Or maybe you believe, like Thomas Huxley did, that there is something special about people, about civilization, that invented a true altruism which only we have. Or maybe you believe, like Kropotkin, that altruism comes from somewhere long ago, a tendency shared by all or most creatures on the earth, and that mutual aid is a good proven not just by morality, but by the amoral hand of nature herself. A lot of you might already know a bit about Hamilton and Price's ideas, whether you can trace them back to them or not, and may have strong feelings about them too. There's no shortage of people out there who are willing to go to the mat for Hamilton and Price, who believe, not without good reason, that the question of altruism was effectively settled by them or some of their peers, particularly John Maynard Smith and everybody's favorite bloviating blowhard, Richard Dawkins. others are happy to write off the ideas of all of them whole cloth. For our purposes, I think we must take the position that these ideas are incredibly valuable and insightful, but not necessarily the whole story. Luckily, I also happen to believe that position is correct. So, those ideas. It was Bill Hamilton, for our purposes at least, who got things going. Hamilton was born in 1936 and raised on books about the two things that would go on to shape his career. On the one hand, he'd read about biology, insects, particularly butterflies. And on the other, he'd read about heroes, soldiers, knights, and other white hats who risked it all to help others. Squaring those interests would represent the majority of his life's work. He attended Cambridge, studying biology for his undergraduate, but increasingly became fascinated by math and genetics, leading him to seek a master's at the London School of Economics, studying demography. His interest, primarily, was in using the modern synthesis of evolution and Mendelian inheritance, promoted by R.A. Fisher and J.B.S. Haldane, to understand the altruism question. I should say here that we can, and will have to, define altruism in two different ways. One is what we commonly call psychological altruism, which is to say, when a person does something to help someone else, what is their intent? Psychological altruism can only exist if such a person is really acting on behalf of the other, in their heart of hearts. If they have some hidden agenda, some secret benefit or selfishness, then they are not psychologically altruistic. For instance, fucking Aristotle thought that there was no such thing as true or psychological altruism because he supposed that any sympathy we had for others was necessarily a reflection of our love of ourselves. It's sort of a weird twist on the golden rule. If you save someone from drowning, it's only because you yourself would not like to drown. Therefore, selfish. But don't get clogged up on that too hard, because what Hamilton was chiefly concerned with was the other kind of altruism, biological altruism. Biological altruism doesn't worry about intent. It simply asks, does the actor injure their own fitness to increase the fitness of another? And the answer to that is a resounding yes. Examples of biological altruism abound. The stinging bee, the honeypot ant, the pronking springbok. So the dilemma was a comparatively simple why. Fisher and Haldane had both hinted at an answer. Actually, according to some accounts, Haldane had actually worked it out, but we'll get back to that down the line. There was some sort of relationship between altruism and close relations. After all, the more closely you're related to someone, the more genetic material you share. And if you sacrifice yourself for the benefit of enough people who share enough genetic material with you, your death as an individual might end up being better for the survival and propagation of your genes than if you'd lived and allowed your relatives to die. Hamilton started running the numbers, trying to formulate a mathematical expression of this principle, and eventually realized that what he was seeing was the inverse of a discovery that had already been made back in the 1920s. Back then, another of the big daddies of the modern synthesis, Sewell Wright, had become interested in the problem of inbreeding, which was perhaps a telling fascination given that his own parents had been first cousins. Eventually, Wright came up with what's called the inbreeding coefficient, a mathematical formula for determining whether individuals are too closely related to safely breed. The math Hamilton was looking at was like a mirror image of that. The more closely related two individuals were, the more sense it made for one to incur a cost on behalf of the other. If the cost to the actor was less than the benefit to the recipient, times the relatedness of the two, the altruistic act made evolutionary sense. After initially being rejected by the journal Nature, which will come up down the line in the same breath as Haldane, Bill Hamilton published his inequality in a paper entitled The Genetical Evolution of Social Behavior in 1964. The inequality would go on to be called Hamilton's Rule, and not long after it was published, it was read by George R. Price. George Price was older than Hamilton, born in New York in 1922. His father had owned an electricity and lighting business that became dominant across Broadway, but he had died when George was four, and his mother had struggled hard and at great self-sacrifice to keep the business, not to mention the family, together. He ended up studying chemistry at the University of Chicago, at just the moment when the University of Chicago was secretly becoming the most important and dangerous place in the world. A year before he graduated, in 1943, Enrico Fermi had built the first nuclear reactor in a squash court underneath the viewing stands at the school's football stadium. U of C was the epicenter for the Manhattan Project. And when Price received his bachelor's, he was urged to stay for his doctorate.
Так, что, Паша, ну что делать? Забей! Я объяснил уже один раз.
And when Price received his bachelor's, he was urged to stay for his doctorate while secretly working on the atom bomb. Price's part in the Manhattan Project wasn't as morally complicated as most.
Еще Аристотель прав. Мы узнали, кто прав. Оно, Аристотель прав. Fucking Аристотель. Ты еще задаешься вопросом, почему существует равновесие состояния популяции волков и зайцев, кто определяет точку этого равновесия. Ну, кто определяет точку этого равновесия? Это как-то странная постановка вопроса. А почему существует и существует ли? Это интересный вопрос, чтобы им задаться. Пока не задался, но когда-нибудь задамся. Я бы даже поставил сначала вопрос. Оно существует?
Oppenheimer and the rest of the higher ups understood that there were a lot of complications to stay for his doctorate while secretly working on the atom bomb. Price's part in the Manhattan Project wasn't as morally complicated as most. Oppenheimer and the rest of the higher-ups understood that there were a lot of risks and concerns that went along with using an atomic weapon, if they could succeed in building it. One of those concerns was that it might ignite the hydrogen in the atmosphere and cause the whole world to burn, a possibility Fermi jokingly took bets on before the first Trinity test. But
Анончик меня триггерит, последнее сообщение. Мы вообще подняли этот вопрос не просто так. Нужен альтруизм, мы в контексте, как он вписывается в теорию эволюции естественного отбора. Я сообщаю его, а вот ты ответил для себя и для нас на вопрос. Как, в чем базовая, что составляет теорию эволюции естественного отбора? Ты ответил? Мы как бы мы именно в этом контексте вообще изначально, да.
Another less immediately shocking possibility was that tiny.
Не отвечай на этот вопрос.
But another, less immediately shocking possibility was that tiny bits of uranium from the bomb might end up getting stuck in stuff, like people stuff.
Тимашин, хорошо, сейчас я тебе объясню на словах, сейчас я буду жать на проверку, и ты увидишь, оно соответствует или не соответствует. Вот смотри внимательно. Ну лучше слушай подкаст.
In the atmosphere and caused the whole world to burn, a possibility Fermi jokingly took bets on before the first Trinity test. But another, less immediately shocking possibility was that tiny bits of uranium from the bomb might end up getting stuck in stuff, like people stuff. George Price was charged with coming up with a way to test for and locate radioactive uranium in living bodies. Having completed that, he returned to his regular studies, earning his doctorate in 1946. For the next few decades, Price had the kind of scientific career few could hope to hold. He was a lecturer at Harvard, a researcher at Bell Labs, a consultant at Argonne National Laboratory.
Второе, Нончик Садонов, Енук. Я догадываюсь, кстати, кто это. Не факт, но детектор у меня так. так, знаете, джерки, вот представьте такое, стрелочку на, так, как это называется, табло, или как вот, как называется, вот эта стрелочка так, тис, так, тыц и вниз, тыц и вниз. Вот детектор у меня вот тут что-то сразу. Так вот, к чему я? Ты помнишь, ты смотрел с нами года 2-3 назад документалку Кёртиса All Watched Over by Machines of Love and Grace? Не знаю, вспомнишь ли ты даже, если смотрел.
A researcher at the scientific career few could hope to hold. He was a lecturer at Harvard, a researcher at Bell Labs, a consultant at Argonne National Laboratory, and an employee at IBM. He built transistors and graphic displays, fluorescence microscopes and computers. He wrote articles debunking ESP and explaining game theory. And then, in 1967, he gave it all up, quit his job at IBM, and moved to London to find Bill Hamilton. Bill Hamilton and George Price had every reason to get along with one another. For starters, neither of them got along well with anybody else. People close to them wondered independently if each of them were on the spectrum. They were much more at ease with animals, numbers, and enzymes than with people. Each of them were married with children, but each of their marriages eventually fell apart, and the relationships with their kids were strained. And each of them were rather adamant atheists, and not especially polite about it. They also both looked the parts of the antisocial scientific weirdo. Hamilton had a dizzying, thick shock of white hair like a geriatric troll doll, and George Price had kept a beard on life support for years in contradiction to all ethical cosmetological advice. But while they were both awkward and misanthropic, they expressed it differently. Price was haphazardly jovial, where Hamilton was prickly and easily embittered. Neither of them could quite recall exactly where and when they'd met, but they both knew why. Inspired by Hamilton's rule, Price had gotten an even bigger idea. He wanted to mathematically model the evolution of families, using the systems logic he'd honed at IBM and the game theory he'd written about in pop science magazines. But he quickly found Hamilton's rule limiting. He wrote to him, out of the blue, to ask whether Hamilton really believed that nepotism was as good as it got. Hamilton sent a pretty brusque response, in which he questioned Price and Price's desire to see a greater, purer kind of altruism. Couldn't that desire itself, Hamilton asked, be just another genetic trick? Maybe some gene had gotten into Price's pool that wanted to diversify the human species for its own good, and it had convinced Price that what he was after was a higher morality than nepotism. Maybe it was a good point. It at least gave Price something to think about, and think about it he did. He worked tirelessly at libraries across London, trying to work out a formal understanding of natural selection that accounted for Hamilton's rule, for altruism, for genetics, for Darwin, for everything. And on many counts, he succeeded. The Price equation is one of those holy shit pieces of math. It's not a theory, it's not a law, it's a self...
Меня не интересовало, что ты прочитал в синопсисе. Прочитав синопсис, ты не можешь понять ничего. Документалка интересная. И вот в одной из серий как раз было про Хамильтона и Прайса, поэтому я так порадовался, когда в первый раз этот эпизод подкаста слышал, что я уже слышал про них. Но тут куда подробнее, чем было в документалке. Тебя еще тут слушаешь, понимаешь более-менее, разбираешь на слух.
Pieces of math. It's not a theory, it's not a law. He's a formal understanding of natural selection that accounted for Hamilton's rule, for altruism, for genetics, for Darwin, for everything. And on many counts, he succeeded. The Price equation is one of those holy shit pieces of math. It's not a theory, it's not a law, it's a self-evident tautology that neatly models the fit, the fitter, and the fittest, and how they all survive or fail to. While mathematicians would balk at the idea that there's anything particularly difficult or complex about the price equation, I am not a mathematician, and neither are some percentage of you, which I couldn't possibly hope to work out even if I had the numbers, because that is how much not a mathematician I am. So, I'm going to skip most of the equation and just try to tell you what it does. The price equation is a mathematical representation of how traits move through populations, reliant on their fitness. So, with the price equation, you can easily quantify how a population of organisms would develop sight. If some small part of that population has some small amount of photosensitivity, the fitness advantage of that will not only give them a leg up in producing offspring in successive generations, but will also prime the improvement of that photosensitivity, until you end up with a whole species that has eyes. That's obvious enough, but the price equation puts it in predictable, hard numbers. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Because eyes are easy. Everybody wants eyes. What about something a little more complicated, like sickle cell anemia? Unlike eyes, nobody wants sickle cell disease, but sickle cell is a recessive trait. So, let's go back to our Gregor Mendel, everybody. Say your parents are both carriers of the sickle cell gene. They each have a recessive sickle cell gene, but they don't have sickle cell disease themselves. When they conceive you, there is a 50% chance you'll receive either gene from either parent. So, that makes for four possible outcomes. One, you get both of your parents' dominant genes. Not only do you not end up with sickle cell, you're not even a carrier. That gene is out of your bloodline. On the other hand, there's a 1 in 4 chance that you end up with both of your parents' recessive genes, in which case you will have sickle cell disease. The other two possibilities are that you get one of each, either the dominant from your mother and recessive from your father, or the other way around. And in either of those cases, you'll end up like your parents, an unaffected sickle cell carrier. But there's a twist. Sickle cell anemia is no fun. It means that some of your red blood cells are flat and curvy, like a sickle, instead of round, like they should be. These crescent-like red blood cells don't carry as much oxygen as normal ones, and they tend to die faster, too. Not only that, but they can be sticky and rigid and cause clotting. But there is one upside. Malaria hates sickle cell. It has a hard time getting into sickle-shaped cells, and an even harder time staying in them, so that the immune system can get rid of the disease relatively easily. And carriers, like the hypothetical you and your hypothetical parents, get some of that anti-malarial benefit without any of the sickle cell downsides. Drop those factors into the price equation, and you get an effective, quantifiable understanding of how sickle cell grows in populations facing malaria and shrinks in those without it. And the equilibrium between sickle cell and malaria is not so different from the one between selfishness and altruism, which also maps very cleanly onto the price equation.
Вот то, что сейчас было, наверное, как-то связано вот с тем, в какую сторону нас Серчаев давит, но, к сожалению, он не способен понять английского, поэтому. Извините, остановил на то, чтобы подъебать. Задумайтесь, как вы давно вы видели. Постоянно вижу в кино. Голубоглазых, по крайней мере. Кого я недавно голубоглазого видел? По-моему, вот прям что мне глаз намылило. Дефалька голубоглазый. Это или это какие? Вот и кто-то еще прям раздражительно голубоглазого.
Rice showed that Hamilton cleanly between selfishness and altruism, which also maps very cleanly onto the price equation. Price showed that Hamilton was wrong, or more like Hamilton was thinking too narrowly. In order for altruism to flourish in a population, the population didn't have to be closely related. It just had to be altruistic. As long as some segment of the population possessed altruistic traits and that altruism benefited that part of the population and helped them reproduce better than the rest, altruism would grow. It had been a century of infighting between the groupies and the indies, and now, finally, the answer was out there. They were both wrong. Natural selection didn't care about individuals or groups. It cared about genes. Evolution was a question of survival of the fittest. The survival of the fittest genes. It didn't matter whether those genes favored individuals or populations, evolution wasn't concerned with either. The pronking springbok and its herd? They were both red herrings. It didn't matter which one survived or flourished, all that mattered was how many of their constituent genes were carried on. Forget individual selection and group selection. After Hamilton's rule, John Maynard Smith coined a new term, kin selection, which you might know better by the title of Richard Dawkins' explainer, The Selfish Gene. The ramifications were seismic. The price equation didn't just explain altruism, it also explained altruism's opposite, which Hamilton named spite.
Итак, родственный отбор. Отбора определяющий совокупность и приспособленность особи. Совокупность или проще отбор направлен на сохранение признаков, благоприятствующих выживанию близких родичей данной особи. Надо на английском читать, а на английском я сейчас говорю читать. Слишком сильно не готов. Ну смотрите, пчелки, сука, тут!
The same way that it made sense for closely related things or groups of things to help one another even if it cost them.
Ты считал, что нет. Нет,
altruism's opposite, which Hamilton named spite. In the same way that it made sense for...
А если что, осталось сколько? 15 это минут.
Closely related things or groups of things to help one another even if it cost them to do so, it also made sense to go out of your way to hurt those who were more distantly related. Because even if it cost you to punch someone else, if that hurt eventually benefited members of your own population, it would end up being worth it. Love and hate were one and the same, the flip sides of a single formula. Not only that, but altruism and spite mixed together could be particularly powerful. In The Selfish Gene, Dawkins, and I promise, I don't want to talk about Richard Dawkins any more than you want to hear about him, but fuck is The Selfish Gene a really good book. In The Selfish Gene, Dawkins presented a hypothetical. Say two mutations cropped up in a population. The first mutation caused their bearers to grow green beards. The second caused their bearers to act altruistically towards those with green beards. Click that into the price equation, and you'll see that in a couple of generations, you'll have a population chock-a-block with green-bearded altruists. But what if you add a third trait, spitefulness, towards those without green beards?
Фрайд, это все... Блядь, иди нахуй. Нет, я не слушаю. Вот, людей либо откровение, либо пятикратно перенаучены. Да. Хорошо, так скажем. Я вот мало научпоп слушал, и вот это прям единственный интересный научпоп, который вот удовлетворил моим вот вкусом, вот да. Так что для меня вот да, открытие, во-первых. Во-вторых, как ты можешь делать какие-то выводы, если ты не понимаешь, что слушаешь, а так просто по темам? Ну ведь по темам, если типа это... Все весь этот переваренный кал, который ты уже слышал. Ну, вроде когда я обычно кидаю вот на главную радио, что я недавно узнал, обычно вроде про что-то ты слышал, но обычно ты про это не слышал. Какое-то странное противоречие. Но ведь если вот все один пятикратный... А ты про него почему-то...
What's really wild about this example is that those three traits, having green beards, helping green beards, and hurting those without green beards, don't even have to exist in the same individuals in order for all three to quickly dominate. You could have individuals who act altruistically towards Greenbeards, even though they themselves are beardless. You could even have individuals acting altruistically towards Beards who acted spitefully back. But not for long, because eventually the beardless would be called out. If you're feeling uneasy about all of this, you are not alone. George Price was right there with you. He bristled at the idea that spite and altruism were one and the same. He shuddered to think that Hamilton might have been right in their initial exchange, that genetics were destiny. And he absolutely loathed the conclusion that he himself had reached, that there was no such thing as true altruism, real selflessness, because his equation proved it was all just a happy, advantaged adaptation. The price equation was far...
Смотри, ну, проследовных европейских сойд... Ну, кстати, проследовных европейских сойд не отсюда устал. Вот смотри, смотри, все, о чем он не слышал, это не нужно, нахуя не нужна информация. Все, о чем он слышал, это пятикратно переваренный научпоперский кал. Какой ты приятный человек, Серчаев.
Advantaged adaptation. The price equation was far from George's last great contribution. He worked with John Maynard Smith to further introduce game theory into evolutionary biology, one of the most important shifts in perspective in the history of the science. And he made several specific contributions to this worldview. He developed a comprehensive theory for why deer grow antlers and rut. He modeled the origin of human monogamous family units. But in the back of his mind, something had changed. It's important to say, before we go any further down this path, that George Price was not a well man. Family and friends noted not just his possible autism, but all kinds of erratic and eccentric behaviors in his youth, which eventually collapsed into deeper and deeper social isolation as he grew older. At one point, he had written to an old friend about being plagued with auditory hallucinations. And before he left IBM and came to England to solve the altruism problem, he developed thyroid cancer, and the treatment had left his body incapable of producing hormones it very much needed. He was dependent on synthetic injections to replace them, and he was less than punctual with that routine. Just before he quit IBM, his brother Edison had had him involuntarily committed. Some would like to chalk up the rest of Price's life to a combination of these issues, but that doesn't seem entirely sufficient. Shortly after his equation, George Price made some big changes. He converted from radical atheism to radical Christianity. He studied the Bible with the same thoroughness that he studied life, suggesting errors and fixes. And he made a plan. The man who had mathematically mapped precisely how life tries, whenever possible, to extend itself as far and as long as it could, decided that he would do the opposite. He would limit his life to 50 years. Both of these shifts came along through a string of complicated logic that only a mind like George Price's could manage to comprehend. But that logic was nevertheless wrong. He appeared to be falling into a trap. Much like John Nash, the father of game theory, George Price was seeing patterns everywhere, and describing meaning to them where none existed. He believed he was chosen by God to discover his covariance equation. Now the question was what he was supposed to do with it. He began trying to convert people to Christianity, friends, near strangers, potential and former lovers, even his children, whose lives he had basically fled when he moved to England. He even made moves on Bill Hamilton, who responded by sending him a copy of Beckett's Waiting for Godot. For a logician like Price, the existence of God didn't present an answer, but a question. The meaning of life in a godless world was easy, to go forth and multiply. His own work had shown that. But with an arbiter on the field, the whole capricious experiment had to have some greater purpose. Life, he felt, was a test, developed by God and deployed upon everyone else. And what was being tested? To his chosen, George Price, the answer was obvious. Altruism. Charity, hospitality to strangers, love of neighbor, agape. God's command wasn't subtle. It had become clear the moment Cain had asked, am I my brother's keeper? And God had answered by placing the mark on him, casting him away from his family, cursing him. In 1972, he turned 50, and instead of opting to die as previously planned, he decided to live in accordance with God's test. It was right there in the Gospels, Luke chapter 6, verse 30. Give to every man that asketh of thee, and of him that taketh away thy goods, ask them not again. He began giving money and food to the homeless, as randomly and against the accordances of his equation and Hamilton's rule as he could manage. The less related to him, the better. He would ask, how can I help? And however they answered, he did. He talked to the police, telling them to leave encampments alone. He came to court to act as a character witness for strangers. By April of 1973, he determined the best way of all to help the homeless, to give them his home. Each night there were new guests. Some of them stayed, some of them left. Some of them stole, some of them drank. Some of them broke things and made threats. George Price welcomed them all and accepted nothing in return. Anyone that stayed more than a day, he gave a key. Anyone who left, he gave cash. Soon enough, he lost his home, and his charges were left again at the mercies of the street. Only this time, George was with them. He took up in a shelter, where it quickly became known that he would abandon his bed with just an ask. He spent his days, nearly penniless, still making his way to Piccadilly Circus, where he continued to ask people how he could help, though he was ostensibly in nearly as much need as any of those he asked. He wrote to his brother Edison to explain his current condition. I have no home, so use my business address as a mail address. Many times each month I find myself reduced to one penny, a half penny, or zero. Most of my possessions have been given away, including my watch and coat. Everywhere I go, I keep running into down-and-out alcoholics, to whom I give when I have anything, and with whom I sit and drink from their bottle if they offer me a drink.
Я не понял ни капли логики в сообщении, поэтому не буду комментировать. И не понял ли, нормально ли понял тот, кто составлял эту логику. Все, что нужно... Но мы как раз об этом и слушаем. Да, мы как раз, кажется, об этом и слушаем. Не читай на английском, обычно в русской Википедии я зачастую обнаруживаю ошибки. Ладно, ну вот в июле, вот я не уверен про эту связь, про то, про начало. В этой пасте. А дальше, да, мы про это, кажется, и слышим.
A substantial amount of my time is given to trying to help people in almost any way they ask me or seem to need help, whether it is by giving them money,
А к чему Хэмилтон пришел, ты знаешь? Точнее, наоборот, блядь, я их говорю. Да, Хэмилтон. Хэмилтон пришел, ты знаешь? Хорошо. Прайс пришел, отчасти к сумасшествию, к религиозности и к радикальному альтруизму, противоречащую вообще-то его исследованию. А к чему пришел Хэмилтон, ты знаешь?
People in almost any way they ask me or seem to need help, whether it is by giving them money, cleaning a filthy kitchen, talking to a landlord, shopping for a housebound person, or trying to solve some mathematical problem for somebody. I usually wear a cross of some aluminum-appearing or pewter-like metal around my neck, except that people keep asking me for it, especially old, sick people and down-and-out alcoholics, and I've given away 7 of them and don't have any now and won't be able to buy another until payday. I generally try to say yes. He also tried to make amends with his family and friends whom he'd previously forsaken, particularly his daughters, but he couldn't try too hard, couldn't focus on people like that, for they were his relations, and any good he showed to them only went to further prove that altruism was a grift. It was best to help strangers. By 1974, he was out of the shelters and into a series.
Что понравилось, не понравилось? Я не понял, что то есть какие-то выводы про формулы и так далее. Причем... ладно, короче, не буду. Я не понял, ни к чему это Маразм.
By 1974, he was out of the shelters and into a series of squats with the help.
Я это не зачитал, хорошее. Мы про это слушаем, как бы в куда более интересном изложении. Ну хорошо, я прочитаю. В июне 1970 года, спустя несколько месяцев после того, как равнение от Грузии начало от Челябинтона, вот это немного спустя, это как бы тут связывает как бы конкретное событие, а этим проблемы альтруизма и прочее, они оба занимались как бы десятилетия. Это не конкретное событие, это то, как он закончил жизнь, это последствия всей его прошлой жизни, так скажем. Джордж Прайс дал у себя во власть Бога, из-за этого дружба с Уильямом начала трещать по швам. Прайс часто избегал своего друга, отказывался ему и рассказывать ему о своих новых пристрастиях. Уильям заподозрил, сделал что-то неладное. Что тоже странное повествование, учитывая, что в том, что мы прослушали, мы кое-что более интересное услышали, по-моему, про то, что Прайс Гамильтон вот что-то говорил о своего новых взглядах. И Хамильтон ему в ответ, в качестве ответа, прислал копию «Waiting for Godot Beckett». Вот. Ну, чтобы понять шутку, надо было смотреть на моем стриме в этом году. Вот. Поэтому, вот, блядь, вот, больше, конечно, я как-то верю повествованию прослушанному подкастера, чем пасти с Википедии. Хотя, возможно, как-то. Возможно, правда, где-то посередине. Просто я вот тут вот конкретно противоречие узнал, увидел. Находясь в состоянии глубокой депрессии, вероятно, потому что именно на его долю выпало доказать эгоистические основы альтруизма, он позволил своему разуму прогнуться под действием своих ночных кошмаров и остаточно потерять здравый смысл. Следующий переломный момент приписывается к окончанию 1972 года. Джордж пришел в заключение, что в этом мире можно полагаться только на Иисуса. Джордж обнаружил его сосед предпёрстном состоянии. Короче, ты... Почему-то ты написал, что хорошо, что не читал хорошую cool story. Это и куда более шире, и куда интереснее рассказывается в том, что мы прослушали. Он не просто, не знаю, покончил, пришел религией, покончил с собой. Он до этого много лет, после религиозного откровения, что это все испытание Бога в том, что на самом деле нужно полностью альтруистично вести жизнь, вот он стал полностью альтруистом и все отдавал бедным, вот. При этом, кстати, продолжая работать в лаборатории или где он там, ну, научной деятельностью заниматься, при этом даже когда уже отдал дом кому-то. Короче, немножко меня покоробило твой интерес вот этой вот пасти на русском, когда слушаем мы кое-что куда более обширное и...
It was hard.
Хочешь переслушаем весь этот. Слушивайся получше. Все равно, кроме тебя особо не осталось. Слушай.
With God's test, his covariance equation, had had to be getting for Godot. People too crispy appeared to both as far
as... Не все, но вот отсюда где-нибудь.
As long as it could, decided that he would do the opposite. Theism would like to chalk up the rest of Price's life to a combination of these issues, but that doesn't seem entirely sufficient. Shortly after his equation, George Price made some big changes. He converted from radical atheism to radical Christianity. He studied the Bible with the same thoroughness that he studied life, suggesting errors and fixes. And he made a plan. The man who had mathematically mapped precisely how life tries, whenever possible, to extend itself as far and as long as it could, decided that he would do the opposite. He would limit his life to 50 years. Both of these shifts came along through a string of complicated logic that only a mind like George Price's could manage to comprehend. But that logic was nevertheless wrong. He appeared to be falling into a trap. Much like John Nash, the father of game theory, George Price was seeing patterns everywhere, and describing meaning to them where none existed. He believed he was chosen by God to discover his covariance equation. Now the question was what he was supposed to do with it. He began trying to convert people to Christianity, friends, near strangers, potential and former lovers, even his children, who